Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here with Russ Chianelli. And today we have a physicist guest. He's somebody that's interested in high-energy laser physics. He's also interested in nuclear physics. And in fact, he's also very interested in what makes a physicist. He's got some really entertaining ideas about how you can determine if your child's going to be a physicist. Russ, who's our guest?
We're very happy to welcome to Science Studio Professor Johann Rafalski. Johann, welcome to Science Studio.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you very much for having me.
That's great. And you're from University of Arizona.
Quite correct, at the moment. Not only for the moment. The question is, what is a moment? 24 years. It's a long moment.
Like a true physicist, it depends what is a moment.
It's a very long moment in my life.
Excellent. Well, welcome here anyway.
Yes. But before
we get into, you know, your area of expertise and your opinions about, you know, how we develop as scientists, tell us a little bit about Johann. Where did you grow up and how did you become, in the end, a scientist and a physicist?
I grew up as a child in Poland.
That helps.
Yes. I know it is a strange thing to say, but because I was growing up also when I was a student and even a postdoctoral fellow.
Even now.
Well, I wanted to stress that the part of growing up as a child was in Poland. I was born in Poland, in the south of Poland, in Krakow, in an environment which was in ruins after the Second World War, to parents who had to start an entirely new life, as many other people after in that period. And so it was not quite obvious how things would turn out. But one thing which was obvious to everybody, that the children had priority, and actually people at that time were giving all their life and all their attention to their children, trying to give them the best of possible futures, something to which I remember very vividly. We sometimes forget because everything is granted and given today. But if you come from an environment which was very tough, you do recognize that children have an important role to play. We have a future, so to speak.
Then the past was the past. Let's work on the future, the
Correct.
Children.
Yes, very important. So I had very understanding parents. My mother didn't pursue a profession. She was, I would say, due to war, half-educated chemist. And my father was a lawyer who loved physics. And he wanted to be a physicist, but before the war, the Great War, there was no real future for a physicist, so his family persuaded him to become a lawyer. So this is how he became a lawyer. But he always read physics books, and I, of course, saw this, and maybe he awakened my interest in looking at these books. But actually, I kind of found them a little bit boring. When I opened them, there were things which I already figured out for myself.
Wait a minute. I want one specific example of this, that you opened as a young child a physics book and you suddenly say, I knew that before I opened this book.
I give you an example which is not actually, may have been mine, but is actually very often quoted and attributed to one of the famous mathematician physicists from French origin, that he, as a young boy, put at a table to dine with parents and family. And somebody drops cutlery on the plate, and there's a sound emitted. And the boy asks, what is this? Why do I hear? How did it happen? And goes on to experiment in his room and figures it out and creates theory of sound of solid objects. So this is a boy of 10 years. Now, I may not have been Pascal at the age of 10 years, but I assure you these are the type of experiences that you question. And you observe, you learn to observe, you have actually talent to observe. You're interested in what you see. You recognize something which you have to explain. You go on trying to reproduce it, trying to actually understand as a child plays in a sandbox. And if you have this particular attitude that you need to resolve the question, which is obviously posed to you by nature, then you become a physicist ultimately. And I see this. These are some students who come my way. They do that. I don't need to ask them a question. They will independently, and they come across such a circumstance, go and dwell in finding out what happened. How was it possible? And they also see, this is very important. The second thing, you not only have to go and investigate, you have to see. Your eyes have to be open to these questions. That's very, very important.
So it's the first sign really is power of observation and curiosity.
Correct. Yes, you have to have curiosity for this type of events, because you see, we all have curiosity. I have not met a human being who is not curious. But the point is, where is the energy going to? What is the type of curiosity which we see?
And these questions in your household, when you postulated the question to your parents, they took this up and continued.
Oh yes, definitely. So, I mean, I had
like
very strong support. Yes,
right.
This is very important.
Absolutely.
That parents must support the children in their studies, so to speak, or in their curiosities. Mm-hmm. And I did, of course, the same with my two children, but I would say that fundamentally, if parents do not respond to child's curiosity, the child takes it someplace else, and then all kinds of known consequences can ensue. So right. We all know that we have to respond to the children, and strangely enough, in science as well as in some other things. So sometimes parents may not be prepared to answer engineering, technically scientific questions. Well, they have to go out and find out the answers, like listening to the show, I would say, right?
Well that's true. And I remember very well when this started in my family, for myself and then for my children. Not my children's children yet, but just the clinking of wine glasses.
Yes.
You know, and I love to listen to it. The ring carries on, and my kids would sort of look at me and say, this is a drink. Why all this sort of theater?
Yes.
But
sound,
then we played the game of filling it up more and less, and it was great fun.
Sound and phenomena related to sound are so close almost daily to the events a child experiences that it's a very often the trigger for scientific curiosity. But also observation of the stars.
Yeah,
you know, which in the Southwest, it's very easy to look up and see all the beauty of it.
It's very difficult not to see them.
Yes, exactly. And this is historically is attributed. Historians of science attribute the star observation of what's at night to be the trigger for our development of sciences.
Okay. Well, so let's go. Where did you go to school? Where did you study? University?
University of Frankfurt in Germany. It turned out that after long enough under the communist regime, my parents decided, you know, you have to balance several evils with each other, and the lesser evil was in Frankfurt, Germany at the time, and that's where they settled, and around 1965, and that's where I went to high school, and that's where I then later studied theoretical physics at the University of Frankfurt, where I got a PhD at a rather young age.
Okay.
So Frankfurt was in the western part, so
western
you left
part,
the east.
Yes, Yes, that's a long story, which has very little to do with science, but with courage of crossing the border somewhat illegally. But in the end, I was not quite. For after a while, I was legalized, and I could be a student and so on.
Just sounds like what happens around in the southwest of the United States.
Absolutely. I am one of the refugees, absolutely and completely, but the refugee from communist system. It was really a decision to make. You want to live oppressed or you want to live free. And there was a risk.
And then you continued this, as so many of us have done, from Europe to the New World. What were the decisions in that process?
Here is mainly a few accidents of life. I was not committed to move to the United States, but I found a friend in one. And so one day, a colleague from the United States, a colleague of my PhD advisor, came to give a lecture at the University of Frankfurt. And I listened to the lecture. I could understand what he says very well, although I was still a young student. And I actually asked some good questions. And the person liked me a lot. And so we became friends. And he invited me over. I came to U.S. He was working at National Bureau of Standards in Washington, D.C. So I came to know Washington, D.C. very well, very quickly. So I went over several times from Frankfurt, Germany to Washington. And I liked U.S., and then what happened was that when you finish your PhD, you have to find a postdoctoral employment, which is sometimes very difficult. And in between, aside of him, there were two other people whom I came across, also from U.S. So this is really the situation. The fact that professors, U.S. professors, traveled in Europe, gave lectures, this is what ultimately brought me back to U.S. because there were these three people who I knew quite well. Two of them made me job offers.
Yeah,
I couldn't refuse. And so I ended up being a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. And after that, I moved to the University of Chicago and Argonne National Laboratory in Chicago. And after a short period again at CERN in Geneva, where I was a fellow, and other adventures, I ended up at the University of Arizona.
And so you've now told us what a wonderful pedigree you have.
Yes.
You know, Penn, Chicago, CERN, and Frankfurt, and now Arizona.
Yeah.
Let's start a little conversation then about the high-energy laser physics and high-energy nuclear physics. Where's the combination? I mean, people think of lasers and they have one vision. They think of nuclear physics. They think of something totally different.
Laser is a quite unique instrument, which one comes to appreciate only slowly. And even as a physicist, I truly grew into this over the last 50 years. The laser exists only 50 years. It was just last year we had 50 years of laser celebration. And this is different from regular light. You could say, what's the difference between a laser and the light we see in, coming out of a regular light source? And it is that all the elements of light are put together in a like a wave on the ocean coherently. So in other words, it's a killer wave, if you wish. We all heard about these extraordinary waves which go through the ocean, can topple ships and destroy everything. And how they arise is not well understood, but they are there. It's now well recognized. And laser is when all the light comes together in a fashion just like to create this one single very hot pulse. And we use the term coherent, but this, I don't want to start now explaining what this precisely means. But for those of us who know, this is the key word. It's a coherent superposition of all the waves.
When you talk about a wave of light, we think of shooting the curl.
You can today, let me just say something very simple. If I wanted to shoot down a satellite with a laser, I could. But this is actually would be a very ineffective way to do it. It is not the best of all the energy-directed weapons you can build. So shooting somebody with a laser is just a popular way of showing its power. Lasers are still a very fragile, a very sensitive instrument in which we have to work very hard to achieve what we call a very high intensity, where the laser can actually touch an elementary object at the level of subatomic physics. That is when laser, which one would associate with optics, become tools of subatomic physics. That's when their strength of their wake is so large, we call it intensity, that they can actually disintegrate atoms into pieces. And that has been achieved already many years ago, and we have a rapid progress, and we are coming to the boundary where we can start actually accelerating particles, elementary particles with these lasers, and disintegrate the smallest pieces of matter.
So the laser is the tool that you use to dissect the nucleus.
The beauty is that it is more. It is, first of all, if you look how people get money for doing this research, it's exactly this way. It's a tool. The science is driven by people interested in instrumentation. They tell correctly, we have here a new way of accelerating particles which will break through all the boundaries and limits which we have before, and this is why we must have enormous resources in order to do it. I, as a theoretical physicist, I have an intrinsically... Theoretical physics means I don't do experiments. I actually imagine in my mind, what could I do with an instrument like this? I see much greater opportunity because a laser contains electrical and magnetic fields, and these fields are so strong that they allow us to probe the most elementary properties of matter. You see, particle physics is usually associated with our endeavor to probe the elementary laws of physics. Because of these new properties that lasers show, the high-intensity lasers show, you can suddenly do this also with high-intensity lasers because of the intrinsically strong electric and magnetic fields. So I look at it as a tool to probe the subatomic elementary laws of physics.
You're listening to Science Studio, Keith Pannell, Russ Chinelli, Johann Rafelski from the University of Arizona Department of Physics. We will be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. David Neisel.
And I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog. For 800 years, we've blamed black rats for the waves of plague that killed millions in Europe. But new data is pointing to the climate in Asia and its impact on the great Asian gerbil.
How? Well, the great gerbil is a natural host of the plague bacterium Yersinia pestis. It was transmitted to humans by fleas and brought to Europe by traders. Once there, it infected rats, which then spread it.
We believe the rats were behind subsequent waves of plague there, but the rodents are still in Europe. So why is there no plague? Researchers theorize these rats were not a reservoir for plague and that each individual wave came from Asia.
They began looking at climate records in tree rings and found the incidence of plague correlated not with climate change in Europe, but with Asia. When the weather was dry in Asia, the gerbil population crashed.
Fleas then sought other hosts, such as traders and their pack animals. Scientists discovered a 15-year lag from the time of dry weather before the plague made it to Europe. They proposed three phases to this lag.
The first, 1 to 2 years, is when fleas seek other hosts. The second phase is the longest at 10 to 12 years, the time required to travel from Central Asia to the Black Sea in southeastern Europe. The third stage involves infection of rats that stow away on ships, spreading plague from harbor to harbor.
To prove this, researchers need DNA sequencing of the European plagues. Genetically distinct bacteria would support this new theory that each wave was introduced from Asia.
If they're similar, then there must be a reservoir for plague in Europe, and other explanations for the pandemics must be considered. As for those cute gerbils in the pet store, don't worry. They're safe.
We are Drs. David Niesel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Russ Chianelli, Johann Rafelski, and we're talking about the use of lasers to probe the inner secrets of particles. And what have you discovered? What is it that you have in your mind experiments? And I can't remember the German expression for mind experiments. What is that?
Gedankenexperiment.
That sounds exactly correct.
Yes.
What have you sort of created in this
okay.
realm?
I must say that sometimes we all go in circles. So it is not something which I started yesterday. When I was a very young boy and started in physics, one of the things which my thesis advisor told me to look at is, can we do what we do now with ions? I was colliding ions with lasers. This was a serious question, and so I investigated for a few months the question of crossing laser beams. It was in the early 70s. And I came to the conclusion with another fellow that we can do nothing with lasers. Lasers are, you know, for 100 years too low in intensity. Lasers turned out to bridge this gap very rapidly. There were discoveries which made completely change the phase. So one should learn from it the lesson, never say to the word never. But so it was an old laugh which happened accidentally, the connection between probing elementary physics with particle acceleration and probing elementary physics with laser, crossing laser beams. Now, what I was always interested in is the vacuum. So I am the Mr. Vacuum in physics. Vacuum is the nothing, the empty space. You would think that there's nothing to be discovered.
Are you sure?
Absolutely, I'm sure. But the truth is it's not exactly empty. And we have to...
It's purely a word.
This is one of the misconceptions which are right. very, very popular. There are what we call quantum fluctuations. So the presence of quantum fluctuations in the vacuum opens the door to many interesting physics challenges.
Matter coming in and out of existence spontaneously.
Correct. That's exactly what my thesis was about. I was one in the very beginning of this development, and this is what I practice today. So this is my claim to fame, in a sense. And what I would like to do is to use these high-intensity lasers to come and create matter out of nothing. So this is really the topic of interest to us. And we have just, for example, to give you an example, we have studied with a graduate student who came with me from Arizona to El Paso. We are looking at a question of what happens when you cross laser pulses. I mean, what kind of energy will these particles which come out of a vacuum, which come to existence, what kind of energy will these particles have? And it turns out they have very relatively high energy, which could be of interest for observing the change in the vacuum, because we call it vacuum decay. Just to be similar, like a radioactive nucleus can decay, we think that the vacuum can decay and materialize into particles. That's how we physicists think about it. When you have some conditions where we change what is really the best, the lowest energy ground state. That's the language of is, you know, when you put something on a table, it can fall off when it comes to the edge. Or when you pull something out which supports it. And this is what we are doing, putting laser across laser beams into the vacuum. We is exactly like making a hole in the table and something drops through and falls out and we say, oh, the particle was produced. And the question is, how far will it fall? What energy will it have? And if we create, and it turns out that with lasers, the stable is very high, so the particles are very high energetic when they fall to the ground, so to speak. And so that's very, very interesting. And this is the latest paper which we actually paper means research publication. I don't know how many people who know it very well. This is a technical term. So when you have a research result, you put it together into research publication, and it is termed a paper, like a term paper.
When you try to publish this idea of a vacuum which spontaneously creates and then at the other end removes matter. Yes. What were the first sort of referees' comments? Nothing gets published without somebody having read
1970, I published such a paper. 70, 71, 72, 73, 74, 75, 76, 80.
Papers.
Yes, 50 papers. I am the Mr. Spontaneous Vacuum Decay. I created this field in a way. Right. And yes, the referees have accepted this idea. Of course, it's a battle, uphill battle, referring. You often come across somebody who has not thought yet about this new idea, and then you have to explain to the referee, be patient, be kind, be...
Or somebody that has another idea that you're destroying.
Correct.
Which we call breaking the rice bowl.
Yes, then you have to ask for a new referee. We all know that, so that peer review is not always a perfect process, but I think it's necessary and keeps us honest, because you see, when I tell a student, what you're doing now will never pass through referring process, I capture myself that I am using it as an excuse to tell the graduate student, work harder. That's very, very important, you know. So it has acquired, in a way, a cloud, you know.
Right.
Behave properly or be punished, you see.
It's the big 900-pound gorilla over there.
Yes, quite right.
Eat up your career if you don't
do it the right way. That's correct. So in a way, it is now an institution. Mm-hmm. And I think it's good to have an institution which supervises, in a way, and keeps you honest. And especially because, you know, sometimes there is a temptation for a quick fix, so to speak.
Let me go back to this spontaneous creation of matter and destruction of matter. Okay, now you're studying it with a laser, right?
Mm-hmm. That's a new thing. That's okay. I missed the vacuum, spontaneous vacuum decay, but the new thing, let's do it with lasers.
All right, but how do we know?
You're introducing energy into the system.
Yes.
I mean, when you introduce the two lasers crossing, you've got energy. Everybody knows out there E is equal to MC squared.
Yes.
And so, therefore, in that sense, you can be transforming into matter.
Correct. That's correct. But the question is how you do it and what happens.
Because the mechanism.
It's a mechanism. So, you see, intrinsically, we would like to understand the laws of physics. With time, these laws of physics are transformed into cell phones, for example. Maxwell wrote down Maxwell equations 100 years before the cell phones came up, or even 120 years. But ultimately, if he didn't write the laws of physics, we wouldn't have a cell phone. And so what I would like to do is to write these new laws of physics. And I can see already now, so early in the game, the interesting features. I mentioned this high energy, which is arising, which, you know, because we are lifting the table so high. So for the spontaneous production of the word was very wisely used. Of particles, electrons and positrons, the antiparticle of electron. We have as a reservoir of energy because the table is lifted high and the particles fall down very high, very much.
These quantum fluctuations, we call them, that are going on all the time. If we make a measurement, we're interfering. So how do we know they're going on all the time?
You see, this is an interesting question which I asked myself in the mid or early 80s. It's a very strange. I mean, you're following my career, if you know, in physics. So then the answer turned out to be not in the study of electrons and positrons, but in the study of quarks. So we went on to study the behavior of what's called quark gluon plasma. The insight grew at the time that the vacuum has a much stronger fluctuation, not in electrons and positrons, but in quarks. You have that the structure of matter is determined by these fluctuations. So in other words, what we consider to be elementary particle, like, for example, a proton, which is made out of free quarks, that the free quarks are kept together not by some forces which are intrinsic to the quarks, but by the fact that that the vacuum has properties just like normal matter, and these quarks cannot propagate in this vacuum. So this is what's called quark confinement. And therefore, the proof that there's a strong fluctuation in the vacuum all the time is the confinement of quarks and a creation of bound pieces of matter. And so I turned my attention to this field for the last 25 years or so, or even longer, not because I wanted to become a particle physicist. It's because the natural evolution of the study of a vacuum at the time was to study the quark confinement phenomenon. And so that's what we did. We understood this very well. And now we are returning so to speak, to study the electron-positron fluctuation, not because the other was not fruitful, but because it's much easier to make a pair of electrons and positrons create matter which is less massive. So the objective is to see things, to confirm the ideas, and with production, a massive production of high-energy electrons and positrons, this would be possible. And so that's how, you know, you turn in circles in science. There's this thing you want to discover in the middle, and you're running around it, trying to find the weak spot, like Indians around the corralled whites, you know, trying to find the weak spot. And then they see where they can jump in, because that's the weakest spot, and that's what we do. So we had made a couple of turns around the scientific center, and now jumping into the crossed laser beams.
Let's just sort of interpose there, because that poses a much bigger question. Is there a possibility that the lay public can ever understand this type of study and its relevance? And is there the possibility that maybe this foundation that you've been creating with your mind experiments is just totally wrong?
Of course. I mean,
what does that leave us?
This leaves us with an island of knowledge. Knowledge is not, as I would like to stress, we do not have a very well understood foundational structure of our universe. We're struggling with this concept.
We only know, 18% of the matter and... Less than that.
Matter we see is 4.6%. Matter we don't see together with the 4.6% is 24%, and 76% is the stuff we don't even know what it is. It's called dark energy.
Dark energy, dark matter, yes.
Yeah, so you see,
and
dark
just explain one more time for us, because we've done this several times. Well, why do we think that there's 60-odd percent that we don't know if we don't know it's there?
Okay. The dark matter is manifesting itself to us through its gravitational effect. In other words, I can tell you like follows. Our galaxy would fly apart in transverse direction. You know, galaxy is a pancake, okay? So you can ask yourself, why do the stars not fly off, in transverse direction? Because they're sitting in a whirl, as we call it, created by a spherical distribution of dark matter. So the dark matter out there is probably squeezing the galaxy, so to speak, to be what it is, what we see it to be, okay?
We've come to the end of the program, Johan. Uh-huh. So that's the proof of dark matter.
That's one. There are like five others. Of dark matter is very much in our hands. We control it.
Okay. We control dark matter.
Dark matter. But dark energy is what is missing, because we see the dynamics of the cosmological dynamics of the universe, how it actually expands and how it accelerates its expansion, and the interpretation of the dynamical evolution of the universe requires the object which we call
dark
matter.
And the rate is increasing.
It's accelerated expansion, in essence. Description. It's anti-gravity.
And okay. We've done something here anti-time. We've sort of gone beyond our allotted time. How does that work?
This is wonderful. If you can solve the problem of time, which is the most elementary of all problems.
We leave that for our producer, Norma Martinez, who we will thank in her absence.
Yeah. We really enjoy having you here, Johan
Rafelski.
Rafelski.
Thank you for listening to Science Studio.
Thank you very much, and thanks to Norma Martinez, our producer.
Thank you very much. Thank you.